We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about pain, how it is we think about it, how the way we think about it has changed over time, and it maybe in some respects hasn't changed much at all. Our guest for the show is Melanie Thernstrom. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, and we'll be talking about a book that she has authored. The title of her book is The Pain Chronicles, and it has a rather long subtitle. That is Cures, Myths, Mysteries, Prayers, Diaries, Brain Scans, Healing, and the Science of Suffering. And it is a book that is in part a memoir. So it's in part about some of her experiences with pain. But it's also an exploration of, as I say, how people have thought about pain over time, about the science of pain control, how it is developed, and how perhaps we have come to an understanding that pain is not just a symptom of disease, that pain, in fact, chronic pain, can be a disease in and of itself with rather serious consequences for both the brain and for the nervous system. Questions are certainly welcome as we talk, and all you need to do to participate in the conversation is to give us a call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455, and you also should feel free to pick up the telephone and feel free to pick up the telephone, yes, and call one of those numbers. But if you'd like to also send your question in by email, feel free to do that, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. So we certainly welcome questions, so we hope people will keep them focused on the topic, but certainly we'd be very happy to hear from people this morning. And Ms. Thernstrom, hello.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we appreciate you giving us your time. Just to talk a little bit about numbers first as a way of starting, and you note in the book that the estimates on the numbers of people who experience chronic pain do indeed vary, but what are some of the kinds of numbers that scientists use?
Chronic pain is remarkably pervasive. The Mayday Fund, a nonprofit group, found 70 million Americans. Other estimates are about 5 to 10% of the population. For me, what was much more striking was not just hearing the gross figures, but actually looking at the surveys and getting a sense of the qualitative issues. One survey, a third of pain patients said they sometimes felt so badly they wanted to die, and half said they would spend all their money on treatment if they knew it would work.
Yeah. And certainly you do note that in the same section of the book where here at the beginning where you talk about some of these numbers, that it is widespread. So we know there are a lot of people who experience pain maybe on a daily basis. It's also something that is misdiagnosed and undertreated.
Indeed. Widely so in both directions. What was one of the things that was most striking to me is that there is a very different way that most doctors understand pain from the way that pain specialists understand pain. And most people with pain are seeking out their primary care physician, and they may not be getting good treatment.
And here, there's another case where you can talk about numbers, and that is for all of the people that are having problems with chronic pain, the number of pain specialists is really pretty small. I think the number that I saw was that there's one pain specialist for every 25,000 patients.
Yeah, no, it's preposterous. And so really, what needs to happen is that ordinary doctors need to have better education about pain, but because we're in a paradigm shift in our understanding of pain, many doctors went to medical school back with the old understanding of pain, and they're just not up on the literature.
Yeah. Well, you actually start with a little bit of a story about another disease, about consumption, and about how it is that people started to think differently about those individuals who suffered consumption when it came to be understood that this was a disease and it had an identifiable biological cause.
Yes, I felt like that was a very inapt analogy, that often diseases are understood as personal problems, understood in all kinds of cultural ways before they are diseases. And so consumption was a state of mind. It was an expression of a weakness of the soul. There were a lot of different kinds of myths about it, an artistic temperament, a corruption of the body. And then suddenly a scientist in the mid-19th century saw it under a microscope, and suddenly consumption becomes tuberculosis, and it has nothing to do with having a consumptive personality. It only has to do with being infected with a pathogen. And chronic pain is also seen as a weakness of the person. It's seen as a personality type. It's interpreted in all these ways. You know, is the person unhappy? Are they looking for attention? And more scientists are looking at the brain and nervous system of people with chronic pain, you know, and studying rats when you damage their nervous system, and they're seeing, no, this is actually a pathology.
Mm-hmm. There seem to be a couple of things that apply, and I wonder whether you think indeed that they do and that they still affect the way that we think about pain and people who are suffering pain. And one of those is the idea that somehow pain is a punishment. And that if you're experiencing pain, well, there has to be some reason. And there's this inclination to say, well, you did something, and that's why it is that you're feeling this pain. It's not just that you're a random victim, that there's some particular connection between you and your life and the fact that you experience the pain.
Yes, I mean, one of the ancient interpretations of pain was as a punishment from the gods. And the earliest writings, the cuneiform tablets of ancient Mesopotamia, are actually filled with references to physical pain, spells to ward off the pain-causing demons, interpretations of priests of what has someone done to bring pain upon them through sin or through displeasing the gods or through the gods' whim or through lack of the gods' willingness to exert themselves to protect the human from demons. Like there was one verse I remember being particularly striking where a sort of more minor god is asking his major god, headache has come forth from the underworld. What has this man done? He does not know.
Hmm. The other thing that I think about, and actually I guess it makes me think about a conversation that I had, now it's been some years now, but it was at some point where we were talking about the issue of, I don't know what sort of word you want to use, physician-assisted suicide, ethical suicide, mm-hmm. that whole collection of things. And the person I was talking to was a clergyman who made this argument, and he made it very strongly, that there was virtue in suffering, and that by bearing up under whatever pain or whatever you were going through was somehow important. It was it was necessary for the spirit. It was good for the spirit. It reminds me of my old Latin teacher in college who used to say jokingly, "Suffering was good for the soul." I think that, and unfortunately, we made him suffer by our lack of erudition. That there's still also that idea that there is some sort of virtue in bearing up and experiencing pain, and that if you ask for pain relief, there's something wrong with you.
Yes. I mean, one of the interesting things about pain, though, is it has a remarkable flexibility of meaning, and the meaning of pain changes with the context. And so I would really ask for I would argue for a distinction between religious pain, self-inflicted pain in a religious rite, chosen suffering that we know from the testament of pilgrims can be a very meaningful, enriching experience. People describe it in all kinds of compelling ways, and I have witnessed those religious rituals myself, and unchosen pain. you know, pain that does not have those meanings, pain in a secular context that the person does not want and wants to get help for. And I think the confusion between those two modes can really impede treatment. If you subliminally feel that you should be suffering or that you're being punished, you're not going to be treating your pain as you should, which is as a disease that is damaging your body.
Hmm. Well, do you think that, how many people do you think fall into that way of thinking about their pain that says that somehow it's deserved and that for that reason they're, or maybe on another level, there's just a kind of acceptance where they simply shouldn't do that. There's no reason for them to have to live with that pain.
Yes. I mean, I think that consciously or more likely unconsciously, I think that the feeling that there's nothing they can do, the feeling that that life is suffering, the feeling they need to accept suffering, really does hold people back from taking effective treatment. I mean, in the course of researching the book, I witnessed hundreds of doctor's appointments because I reported it by following pain doctors on their daily rounds and their daily appointments in 7 pain clinics in different parts of the country. And most of the patients, many of them were coming in for first consultations, and most of them had had pain for more than 5 years. And so it had taken them that long to get their way to a pain specialist. Of course, you know, there are many barriers to that. But I do think there are social barriers, there are insurance barriers, there are referral barriers. But I think an important barrier is their own lack of persistence in getting treatment and their own feeling of being defeated, feeling there's nothing they can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
I write about one very interesting survey which found that patients who like and trust their physicians are at more risk for being undertreated for pain because they are more likely to believe that their physician is doing everything he can or she can, and that therefore they simply need to accept their pain, and they're much less likely to ask for a referral. Yeah. Indeed, it found that a physician or nurse simply saying, "I want your pain to get better," or "I wish I could treat your pain," was likely to hold them back that much more.
What exactly is the difference between the understanding of pain and the ability to do something for a patient that's experiencing pain? The difference between, let us say, what a family practice doctor, a general kind of doctor can do, and what a pain specialist can do?
The primary difference is that many doctors have the old paradigm of pain, which is the paradigm that came about in the 18th century. In earlier times, the pre-modern paradigm was pain as a spiritual signifier, as something that comes from demons or deities and is not just a bodily experience. And then in the 18th century, 17th, 18th century, you had a gradual shift to a biological paradigm of pain where it was seen as a signal, a biological signal coming from the periphery of the body indicating tissue damage. And many doctors are stuck in that. And so they think, well, if you have pain, you should have an injury. And they look at your back. Maybe they even do an MRI, and they say, back looks fine. I don't know why you have pain. You really shouldn't. Maybe you're stressed. Maybe you need counseling. You know, not that counseling doesn't help, but they don't understand the contemporary understanding of pain, which is that it's a perception of the brain, and it is generated solely in the brain. And sometimes it's a result of incoming signals from the body, and sometimes it indicates tissue damage. But chronic pain is a disease in and of itself, and it's simply a pathology. It's a mistake of the nervous system. And the injury may have disappeared years ago, but yet the pain alarm is still activated.
Mm-hmm. So it's a malfunction, it's a misfunction of a normal body system Like, for example, that I'm sure people have heard about this. A person can have a limb amputated, but then they could say that not only do they still feel it, they can say that it hurts, even though that it's not there anymore.
Yes. I mean, phantom limb pain was one of the sort of striking counter examples that always, it baffled Descartes, and it always called into question this idea that pain comes from the body. Because if pain actually comes from the body, how do you feel pain in a hand that no longer is there? Mm-hmm. And the explanation is that you are feeling pain. You are having activation in the neurons in the part of the brain that map the body. And for a while it was believed, well, maybe there's tissue signals coming from the stump, and that's causing pain. Maybe the stump is hurting. But it didn't really explain, like, well, why then, you know, if the stump is at the elbow, why do the fingers hurt? Or why does it feel cramped? And that's because the map of the hand and the body, the neurons that are having the cramp, that may have had a cramp right before the amputation, those are stuck in the cramping mode, and they can't uncramp because the hand isn't there to uncramp.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Melanie Thernstrom. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine and is the author of the book The Pain Chronicles, which looks at how it is we think about pain, how that has changed over time, in some cases how it's not changed over time, about the modern science of pain, trying to understand pain and relieve pain. You can read all about that in the book. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe I could ask you for a moment to talk about some of your own experiences with pain, because as I mentioned, part of the book is you're writing about your own experiences, and this was actually something I think that predated the assignment from the magazine, from New York Times Magazine, to write this article.
Yes. 14 years ago, I went swimming across a pond with a boyfriend, and it seemed like it all went perfectly fine. But that night, I was kept awake by a strange burning pain in my right arm and shoulder and neck, and I was just completely baffled by it, and I thought it would go away, and it didn't. It got worse over time, and I made some haphazard efforts to get medical help, and I was told different things, and was basically told it would go away, and that I must have strained something, but I hadn't strained something, and it didn't go away. And after a couple of years, I got an MRI and found out I have type of degenerative arthritis and some other problems in my cervical spine. And then I was just very despairing about it, and I didn't get good treatment. And it was only because I happened to get a magazine assignment and began to research pain that I gained an understanding of pain, and that understanding is what allowed me to find effective treatment. And so I wrote the book in part to share my findings with other people with pain.
So that must have been, at the time that you got the assignment, did you somehow inside say to yourself, ha-ha, now this was going to give me an opportunity to maybe learn some things for myself?
Yes, I remember my editor. I was having lunch with my editor, and I was just in a glaze of misery. Like, I was just feeling in terrible pain, and I could hardly pay attention to the conversation. And I remember he was mentioning different ideas for assignments, like personal bankruptcy, a celebrity profile, chronic pain. And I sort of woke up out of my stupor and said, chronic pain? Yes, that's what I'd like to write about. And is there even treatment for pain? And so that I don't feel like I had even heard of a pain clinic. I certainly hadn't had the idea of going to one.
Uh-huh. And did you happen to say to the other, and by the way, I'm having this experience myself, or did you kind of keep that to yourself?
No, I can't remember. I can't remember. I was pretty secretive about it, so I probably didn't say anything. For some reason, I was ashamed of it, but I really don't. You know, I don't know why that is, but I was bent. I'm actually a fairly confessional person in general, but I was bent on keeping it secret.
something that seems to be the case, or at least we talk about pain this way, is that it is something that certainly it varies from person to person. So that's it's difficult to know what the quality of another person's pain is. They can try to describe it to you. They can try to assign a numerical value, which we often do. But it's really difficult to know what another person is experiencing. And we also, I think, have this idea that some people have a much greater tolerance for pain than others. And, you know, the kind of pain that I might describe as being a six, you might say for you, that's only a three. Is that really the case, that there can be a big difference in people's ability to put up with pain?
Yes. There is a big difference in tolerance, particularly tolerance of acute pain, like tolerance in laboratory tests. And you both see a lot of variation among individuals, but you also see variation by groups. Women are more sensitive to pain than men are. Men tolerate pain more. Young men tolerate pain more than older men. So it appears that different populations have different pain modulation abilities. And it also depends on circumstance. One interesting study I wrote about found that rowers who row in a group, then if you give them a painful stimulus, their bodies will modulate it more. There will be more pain activation than if they train alone and then you give them the same painful stimulus. So it appears that if the communal feeling of exercise actually generates more endorphins and other activates the pain modulation system. Another very interesting study I wrote about is the way in which romantic love activates the pain modulation system. When it involved students who were newly in love, who described themselves as passionately in love, thinking about their beloved, you know, more than 30 times a day, or some very, you know, serious criteria for love. They brought in a picture of their beloved and a picture of an equally attractive acquaintance, and then they were given a painful heat stimulus. And when shown the picture of their beloved, they had a 46% reduction in pain. Like, and it's not just they described themselves as having less pain. Like, their brains actually activated less.
Just going back for a moment to the men and women in pain, you said that there's evidence to show that younger men tolerate pain better than older men, and that it seems that men tolerate pain better than women. At the same time, we know that there's certain sorts of social rules or expectations of men and women and how they behave, and it seems that men, we're going back to this thing where somehow men are supposed to be tough and stoic, and maybe they're going to be less likely to talk about their pain. For women to talk about what's going on with them, what they're feeling, seems to be more acceptable. So is it possible to tease out, are there actual physiological differences in how men and women generally experience pain, and how do social expectations of men and women and how they're supposed to behave influence maybe not only how people talk about pain, but is there even a way that that actually influences the way people experience pain?
Right. I mean, those are difficult questions to tease out, but functional brain imaging scans, you know, look at the amount of activation in the brain, and so you can get a sense of what kind of pain experience the person is having. And also there are other kinds, but which is not to say that isn't linked to culture itself. There are other kinds of pain toleration tests that measure the firing of the nerves, and so you can see, you know, how much firing you're getting from a painful stimulus, and so that's another kind of measure. Like, for example, obese people will not report more pain in a laboratory test. And yet, when they studied actually how is their body responding to a painful stimulus, they found that they're getting a lot more activation. And so their body is actually tolerating pain much less well, even though for whatever reason, social pressure, they're claiming that they're not complaining of pain more than, you know, the thin volunteers or the volunteers of normal body weight.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. This is someone who's listening in Chicago. We'll go there on our line four.
Thank you.
Yes.
There are different modalities for treating and addressing pain, and I was wondering if you'd heard of them or know about things like hypnosis. This has been helpful for subduing and controlling pain. And then there's some electrical ones called the TENS unit. I believe in Canada and University of Florida and other places have increased their units that helpful in treating pain from children and on to adulthood. And these things are applicable, as well as the pharmaceutical components that, you know, got publicity, like OxyContin, but that one was prone to be addictive. Apparently, and then they have developed a non-addictive form of OxyContin as well as morphine and other things. Could you comment on the general areas for controlling pain?
Yes, I mean, all the ones you've mentioned can be very helpful depending on the person and the type of pain that they have. And they all have sort of different. Different pros and cons. TENS unit can be very helpful to some people and has, no risk and no harm in trying it. It works by trying to jam the signals that are coming into the brain, and so it just provides an alternate stimulation. And the idea is that the signals that it's producing will override. The signals the brain is interpreting as pain, and the brain, will become distracted and confused. Some people find it very helpful. Hypnosis, some people, again, find it very helpful. I guess the issue, hypnosis is focusing your attention and blocking out all stimuli except for the one that the hypnotist is leading you to focus on, and that would include pain. And so people are able to achieve a pain-free state. The question with hypnosis is how do you, when the hypnotic trance ends, do you still have pain? And does that actually help you control your pain when you're not doing the hypnosis? And some people feel like there's a carryover into their everyday life, and some people don't. And some people also feel like they learn the technique of self-hypnosis, and so when they're in bad pain, they can just take 10 minutes and practice self-hypnosis and reduce their pain or reduce their pain when they're going to sleep. So I think that can be very valuable to learn. And then I think the final thing you mentioned was
OxyContin.
Yeah.
And morphine, I believe, are synthetic forms that are not addictive.
Right. Well, there are not. There are no forms of opiate pain medication that are not addictive. That just isn't true. However, addiction among pain patients is very rare. Most studies have found it at less than 1%, and addiction is a disease with a strong biological predisposition. And so if you're 50 years old and you've never suffered from addiction in your life, you probably don't have either the genetic predisposition to addiction or the personality traits that lend themselves to make themselves vulnerable to addiction. So it's very unlikely someone who's never been addicted is suddenly going to become addicted to pain medication.
One other thing was the effectiveness of acupuncture. I heard some dental clinics were using acupuncture in treating dental work that was painful, as well as in the Orient, they were using acupuncture to even open up the chest of heart surgery patients.
Right, certainly. Some people have great success with acupuncture. I mean, the problem and the challenge of having pain is that there isn't a clear path for people to take usually with their pain. And so they have to try a whole bunch of different things. And for some people, acupuncture is the answer, and for other people, it isn't at all. And so people tend to try one or two things, and then they become discouraged and decide that nothing will help.
Hmm. Where, and that's perhaps, again, what you would get if you were dealing with a pain specialist. That person would be would know the entire range of things that might be tried. And so that then if you try a couple of things and they don't work, then that person would say, okay, here's something else we can try. And the hope would be that you would continue to try things until you got something that would be effective.
Exactly. I mean, I think the core issue is that although, you know, when person A says they're in pain and person B says they're in pain, it sounds like they're saying the same thing. In fact, different types of pain have very different mechanisms. And so they're, what ideally the doctor would like to know is, okay, well, it hurts, but is it inflammatory pain? Is this muscular pain? Is this neuropathic pain, pain that comes from damage to the nerve system? Because each of these types of pain actually respond to different types of treatment, even though the symptoms of them overlap. And so if you have neuropathic pain, you might benefit from a nerve-stabilizing medicine. If you have muscular pain, you might benefit from massage, from physical therapy, from muscle relaxants, from heat. If you have inflammatory pain, you might benefit from Celebrex or other anti-inflammatory drugs. And so you have to, in a way, often doctors can only deduce the type of pain the person has by working backwards from looking at what treatments work for them.
Just to, and to return just for a second to the subject of opioid medications, I think that I'm sure that we could find people who had very serious problems with pain and who could take these medications very successfully, could get relief from their pain, could manage to function normally, in fact, could manage to function normally in ways that they couldn't otherwise and have done really well, but that it's difficult, sometimes I think it's difficult to get doctors to agree to prescribe these medications for the concerns that have been cited, that is that they are addictive, they're controlled substances, and that maybe there are people who actually could benefit from these medicines but who aren't getting them because doctors are reluctant to prescribe them.
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, it really is a tragic situation. With one pain doctor I interviewed said, the war on drugs has really hurt the war on pain. And it is a very odd situation that you have the very few people who become addicted, you know, or people who feign pain in order to get pain medication and misuse it. How is it that those people have been able to dominate the conversation so much that people who would benefit from these drugs are denied them? Like, we don't, you know, as a pain doctor said to me, we don't ban driving because some people drive drunk, and we don't ration food because some people overeat. And so you definitely have a situation where there are people where opiates really turned their life around, and they were able to be productive members of society, and then they lost, they were unable to find a doctor who was willing to prescribe for them, you know, when there was a backlash against OxyContin, for example, and they returned to being in a state of being chronically disabled by pain. There have been a number of prosecutions of doctors. I write about one in detail, one case in detail in the book of a Dr. Ronald McIver, who was prosecuted and is, in fact, still in prison because some of his patients, unknowingly to him, misused opiate pain medication. And some of them sold it, and some of them just took it to get high and testified in his trial that they actually faked their pain in order to get the medication. And it's astonishing to think that he there was really no evidence that he had any knowledge of this whatsoever, and yet he was held responsible for it and imprisoned for it. And when you have one case like that, believe me, every other physician considering prescribing or prescribing opiate medications thinks twice, and they think, wow, you know, I have a busy practice. I have hundreds of patients. All that has to happen is one of them has to sell their drugs or overdose, and I'm going to go to prison and lose my license? I don't think so, and they all stop prescribing.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Melanie Thernstrom. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. We're talking about her new book, The Pain Chronicles, Cures, Myths, Mysteries, Prayers, Diaries, Brain Scans, Healing, and the Science of Suffering. Just recently come out, published by Ferrer, Strauss, and Giroux, and it really grew out of a magazine article that she wrote for the New York Times Magazine about chronic pain and pain control. And she writes in the book about some of the things that she learned, about some of her experiences with pain, and says that she really felt that she learned a lot, that some of that helped her, and so she thought it would be a good thing to write a book to bring some of that information to other people who were living with pain and trying to deal with their pain, and that's what the book is about, and looks both at how we think about pain and about how modern medicine is trying to help people who are experiencing pain. That's what the book is about. It's out in the bookstore. I'm sure you can find it. You want to look for it. Questions are welcome to 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a couple of other callers here. We'll go back to Chicago for another. Line 4, hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I'd like to know what role inflammation plays in pain and what you could do about inflammation.
Well, I don't know, Melanie, you're not a doctor, can you respond at all to that question?
And the question was the role that information...
I think she was saying inflammation.
Inflammation releases, or it's a fluid bath that has chemicals that irritate nerves, and so... So that's why you get pain with inflammation. It's a process that's designed to bring healing. Those chemicals, you know, are a product of immune response, but they also irritate the nerves. And so there's a whole category of drugs, anti-inflammatory drugs, that target inflammation and can help a great deal with certain kinds of pain. Inflammation is a very healthy response to an injury because it's going to help it heal, but chronic inflammation, like you see in chronic pain, is a very unhealthy phenomenon.
I don't know. Does that help?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We'll go back here to someone here where we are, someone in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
I wondered if I didn't hear the whole program, so it may have been covered. I wondered if you could comment on medical marijuana and pain and whether it actually is something that's useful. I know they do it in California. I wonder if you could comment on that. Thank you.
Yeah.
No,
okay.
The literature that I did not research this extensively. The literature I've seen has not actually found medical marijuana to be that strong and analgesic. Medical marijuana seems to have benefits for all kinds of medical problems, but pain per se actually seems to not be particularly effective. But that said, I did not research it exhaustively. I actually don't cover it in the book. I think that may have been an omission, but in fact, a reviewer pointed it out as an omission, and I would agree with that. But the pain doctors that I observed did not think it was very beneficial for their patients.
Well, in terms of medications, we have talked, for example, the earlier caller talked a little bit about the opioid medications, and those things have existed, and we have known about them, opium and its derivatives, for a long time. Are there particular things that, though are new and very exciting and show a lot of promise, that will help with chronic pain and perhaps don't have some of the undesirable side effects that other things, things that we have been using for a long time, do have.
In terms of medication?
In terms of medication.
Well, I wouldn't say there's anything new. I would say it's more, I mean, there may be things coming, but I would say it's more a matter of the fact that most patients haven't actually tried all the existing pharmacological options.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we were talking about it earlier, they may not have tried Celebrex because the doctor isn't thinking they have inflammatory pain, but there isn't really a good test for knowing what type of pain they have. This category of nerve-stabilizing medicines like Neurontin can be very helpful for neuropathic pain, and those are very often not tried by patients. And I think that patients often have the idea that opiate pain medications, those are clearly the solution, that those will help them. And I think that they have so much sort of mystique about them, and I think I had the dim impression, they're dangerous, but they're also, incredibly powerful, and they would cure my pain. And I was astonished when I finally tried, I can't remember if it was like Percocet or Vicodin, but one of those, and it made me feel ill. It made me feel nauseous and blurry and dizzy, and it didn't even take away all my pain. And in fact, neuropathic pain is unfortunately the kind of pain that opiates are the least effective.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really not a magic answer for everyone. And when you, even if you put aside the issue of addiction, and I think the issue of addiction is overplayed, they have tremendous side effects, and they don't cure everyone's pain. And so patients really have to experiment with a whole wide range of medications.
We have just about 5 or 6 minutes left. Time has gone very quickly here. We have some other callers, and we'll try to get a few folks in the time that remains. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And now we have another person in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm calling to wonder if your guest started the book with the benefits of pain. Pain is a natural thing. If you hit your finger with a hammer, if you didn't have pain, you probably wouldn't do anything about it. if you have an accident and it's that kind of a pain, I think your distinction of the different kinds of pain is very, very significant. And so I'm probably talking about a different kind of pain. But the body has these mechanisms before. I mean, I guess everybody's always tried to use some kind of antidote other than the body, but very often if the body is in pain, its own immune system or its own neurological system or whatever will respond if it's not interfered with directly.
Yes,
with other things. And I wondered if you'd gone into that in the book at all.
Yes, I mean, that, thank you for that comment. That is the critical distinction between acute pain, which is also called protective pain and protects the body, and chronic pain, which is also called non-protective pain, which it has no protective function. It has outlived its usefulness. And there is a rare genetic disease called congenital analgesia, where people lack the ability to feel any pain. And it sort of sounds like, wow, what a great disease to have, are these people living in the Garden of Eden? But in fact, they live terrible lives. They always die, in their teens or early 20s because they just destroy their bodies. They'll walk backwards, on their ankles. They'll chew their tongues. They'll gouge their eyes. You see how quickly the body is destroyed without our continual feedback, no, you're doing the wrong thing. You need to take care of me exactly thus.
Mm. Well, that, I guess, invites a question about in dealing with chronic pain, can you block the mechanism that operates there for the chronic pain without disturbing people's ability to experience the protective pain that you really need to have.
Sorry, say that again.
I'd say if you're trying to treat someone with chronic pain, mm-hmm. Is it possible to deal with the chronic pain without then taking away the other kind of pain, the protective pain, which people need? You know, it's the don't touch the hot stove pain.
Do you end up blocking
the necessary pain, and so you end up with somebody who doesn't who won't feel pain no matter what?
None of the I mean, opiates, for example, you would still scream if you touched a hot object. Mm-hmm. They do not interfere with acute protective pain. Being under anesthesia does, no pain treatment that you would live with and be conscious for would actually interfere with your ability to feel acute pain. You know, and that's why, you know, we don't say just numb. Like if you have, you know, say a cut on your finger, you don't just numb out the whole hand. Because you want the hand to still work and to still feel pain.
All right. I want to thank the caller and go to somebody else. And this is somebody in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I'm calling to ask what she feels about the procedure ablation.
Oh, yeah. And for what type of pain, you know, what type of ablation?
It would be... in the cervical area, I've been plagued with pain ever since a fall about 15 years ago, and I had a cervical fusion at that time. And then right now I'm in bed because I fell less than 2 weeks ago and cracked my pelvis. And I do seem to be accident prone, but with the medications that I have tried, the side effects sometimes are worse than the pain effects themselves.
Right.
So I'm in a pain management clinic with Carl, and they were suggesting, and I was scheduled before I fell, for an ablation.
Right. Right. So as David pointed out, you know, I'm not a doctor, and so I definitely can't give any medical advice, but I just want to, don't misunderstand me as giving you.
No, I understand.
Advice, but
it's generalities.
Right. I'll just comment generally that ablations, which is burning the nerve or cutting the nerve,
mm-hmm.
that used to be believed to be the, a great pain treatment. They thought, if the nerve is hurting you, why don't we cut it? And it turned out that the nerves grow back. And as a pain doctor put it, when they come back angry. And so they often grow back in an irregular pattern, and you get what's called a neuroma, and you can have much worse pain. And so it's a risky treatment. It's often used in terminal illnesses where they...
Gosh, they haven't said anything about that.
Yeah, a lot of times, like, they're called neurodestructive techniques where you destroy nerves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, in a terminal case, by the time the person, you know, they grow back, the person may have passed away, or they may do it a couple of times. But outside that, it is very risky. I think that it works for some people, but I think some people, their pain gets much worse.
I see.
But, so that, you know, that would be a general concern about those techniques. That then I would specifically discuss with your doctor in your case.
Okay, and the other thing is the Botox injections in the pain areas. I've gone through those as well.
Yes, and Botox can be a terrific treatment because it doesn't have side effects.
Right.
And so it's a very low investment on the patient's part to try it,
mm-hmm.
and it's very safe, and it wears off after 3 or 4 months.
Right. Right.
Did you find that those helped you?
I found they were very helpful. It was just that they did wear off, and I was recommend another doctor to try, because as you can probably tell, I've tried everything. And this was the first doctor who helped me with my pain. And he's far away from where I am, and so we were going to try a doctor in Chicago to see if he would do the Botox, because not a lot of doctors do that around here.
Interesting, yes. Botox is actually a treatment that I write about in the book that helped me personally, that I get Botox injections in my neck and shoulder. And
that's where mine is, yes.
The right, I also have pain on the right side of my face, and so I get Botox there. And I find that they are very helpful.
All right. Well, I appreciate your taking my call.
All right. Thank you. Well,
so,
we're here at the end of the time, and I'm sorry to say we have a couple of people that we can't take. There's a lot in this book that we haven't discussed. There's some information here about the development of the science of anesthesia, for example, and more about pain treatment. So if you're interested in the subject, I would certainly suggest that you seek out the book, which, again, is titled The Pain Chronicles. It's published by Ferris Strauss Giroux, by our guest Melanie Thernstrom. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. And Ms. Thernstrom, thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a great conversation.